In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with historian and writer Diana Preston about her new book, which is titled Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima. And it's a book that takes a look at the history and the developments, roughly speaking, between the discovery of radium by Marie Curie in 1898 and the detonation of the first atomic bomb in 1945. In the early decades of the last century, scientists from all over the world worked together to learn the secrets of the atom, with really very little in the way of an idea of where that work might go. Certainly, they weren't thinking about the atomic bomb. However, in less than 50 years, as our guest says, what was once an open and joyous quest for knowledge became a sprint to develop the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. And you can read all about it if you go take a look at the book Before the Fallout. Walker is the publisher. It's quite new. And she is right at the moment spending some time in the United States talking about it. She was born and raised in London. She studied modern history at Oxford, where she first became involved in journalism. After earning her degree there, she became a freelance writer. She has contributed book reviews to a number of publications, including The Wall Street Journal and The LA Times. She's also been a broadcaster for both the BBC and the CBC. 8 years ago, she started writing about history and since has published a number of books, among them books about the sinking of the Lusitania and the Boxer Rebellion. She will be in the Midwest on Monday. She'll be at the University of Chicago, as a matter of fact, at the 57th Street Bookstore, and she'll be giving a talk at 7 p.m. This is on Monday, May 16th. So people who are listening to us up in the Chicago area, if you were interested in hearing her and meeting her, you can go down there. Otherwise, if you'd like to read the book or some of her other work, you can head down to the bookstore. Also here, of course, this morning, we'd be happy to have questions from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, so that we can get in as many as possible, keep the program moving. Anyone, however, listening is welcome to call. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, and we do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Anybody else, 800-222-9455. Ms. Preston, hello.
Oh, good morning.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.
I appreciate it. The title that you've selected for the book obviously invites us to think about this story as a loss of innocence almost on a cosmic scale. Do you think, in fact, that that is what this story is?
I think that's exactly what this story is. It seemed to me that really the development of the atomic bomb, the dropping of the bomb, it was one of the greatest watersheds in human history. The day after that had happened, nothing would ever be the same again. And I think it struck me particularly because I'm the generation that sort of grew up after the Second World War. And I remember, that's when I was a very little girl at school, walking around the playground at my school, linking arms with other children, and we were surged backwards and forwards, and we were shouting, ban the bomb, ban the bomb. And I didn't even know, when I was eight years old, you know, what a bomb was. What was this thing? Where had it come from? But as I say, I'm the generation that has grown up with this, you know, shadow over us, you know, the knowledge that we human beings, with all our cleverness and all our creativity, we've actually managed to develop something which ultimately could destroy us, our planet, our environment. Mm. It's quite a thought.
One of the questions you ask, it's again the question that's many historians confront, no matter what it is they're writing about, is how might things have gone differently? And I think you feel that there are along this timeline that you chart out, there are many places where things perhaps would have gone differently. However, there also is this question of the ultimate outcome, and that is if not at this time, would someone at some point have developed a nuclear weapon? And so we can't really say that if things had gone differently, there would be no bomb at all ever. Do you think that somehow the move from discovering radiation and learning more about what was happening at the subatomic level and how atoms were structured and how they could be manipulated, that all of that must lead inevitably at some point, if not in 1945, then later, to nuclear weapons?
Yes. I was fascinated by that because it seemed to me, as you say, this whole story which starts you know, back at the end of the 19th century, people starting to realize that the atom was not the smallest unit of matter, started to tinker about with it, to probe inside it. How all of that could have led within really such a relatively short period of time to the ultimate destructive weapon. And you say, you know, you just asked a very good question. Was it inevitable where this was going to end up? And it seemed to me that for many years of the story that I look at in the book, it was scientists trying to assemble a jigsaw puzzle, if you like, finding pieces to fit into a picture. But nobody really knew what that overall picture was. You find, you know, as late as 1933, one of the greatest experimental scientists, Ernest Rutherford, the man who actually deduced that at the heart of the atom was the nucleus, you find Ernest Rutherford saying, you know, the idea of actually harnessing energy from atoms to use, you know, either for nuclear power or explosively, he called it moonshine. He said it was completely impossible. And yet, with developments in the 1930s, the political developments, you find everything starts to accelerate. You find that you have the discovery of fission, nuclear fission, happening on the very eve of the outbreak of war. In the most catastrophic and difficult of circumstances, this piece of knowledge is finally understood and interpreted. Everything starts accelerating from that moment because we're going into world war. It becomes a race. And yet, if you hadn't had the pressure of external developments, of what was going on in Europe, that knowledge would have come at some point, but it wouldn't have happened so quickly. Because of the political situation, it did become a race. Because of the political situation, because of war, governments were prepared to suddenly pour enormous resources into the technology to actually make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the reason that the United States won this race, perhaps there are many reasons, but one fundamental reason could be that we indeed had more resources to pour in it than anybody else.
Absolutely. And this was very clearly recognized, you know, by the British government. You had the British government in the early stages of the war fighting a desperate battle against the Germans. Britain alone at that stage, realizing that absolutely, even though the science was well understood, absolutely no question of being able to embark on a project of that size without help. So sending emissaries over to the United States, arguing, saying, look, you know, this is what we found. This is what we believe to be the case. We do believe a nuclear weapon is viable, but we need your help. We need your support. And so eventually it becomes an American project. It could never have happened without the might of the American economy. And so you have America investing in a project which became the same size as the U.S. car industry. You know, imagine those resources. Nobody else could have done it, I think.
Hmm. It's interesting to think back and to go back, as you do, to look at what the world of physics was like in the early years of the last century. As you explained, that in the early 1900s, there actually weren't very many physicists, and of those, the number that were working on radioactivity was even smaller. It was a very small community of individuals, one where everybody knew everybody else.
Absolutely. Now, I found it quite extraordinary. If you open the Encyclopedia Britannica for the early 20th century, right? So if you look at 1900, you know, physics barely gets a mention. And you find, you know, scientists advising other scientists that if they want to develop their careers, you know, physics is probably not necessarily the field to go into. After all, we know most of what there is to know about the physical world, don't we? And then within a very few years, all of that is being stood on its head, you know, from Marie Curie's experiments, building on the work of William Röntgen, the discoverer of X-rays, of the work of Henri Becquerel, the Frenchman who discovered radioactivity. You have this knowledge starting to develop that there is something going on within the atom. There is some power in there. There are elements within the atom that need to be better understood. But as you say, it was a tiny community. And, you know, in the early 1900s, there were probably, across the whole world, maybe 100 scientists involved in this area. And I'm talking about, you know, from Japan to Europe to a little bit later on the United States. So a very small, almost like a band of brothers, you could call them. They knew each other. They studied with each other. They went to each other's laboratories. They met at conferences. They really were, at that stage, a band of friends exploring this exciting new area of science with little thought of international rivalry or politics or all the things that were going to intervene later on.
And that's also something that I think is an interesting feature of this story, and that is the way that certainly there were many key people involved in exploring this area, but that it seemed that each individual, while their contribution was very significant, that it took a number of people making their contributions and each person advancing things just a little bit. And here, again, I guess the metaphor that seems appealing is the metaphor of the chain reaction and the way that one person's discovery and their ideas led the next person to take the next step, and someone after that took another step, and that it proceeded that way. And it was, again, a result of a kind of collective mind, all of these individuals working together, each person contributing one little bit.
Exactly, and that's why I think of it as a jigsaw puzzle starting to come together. As you say, people working together, sharing their findings, and you find sort of strange phases. Sometimes the experimental data is running ahead of the theory that can help interpret that data. It's sometimes as a kind of leapfrogging of knowledge going on. But everybody working with everybody else. You have Ernest Rutherford deducing that the atom was not some sort of solid structure, as some people were arguing, that actually it was a whole load of nothing, with at its heart a very, very tiny, very powerful nucleus. And he starts to work with the Dane Niels Bohr, and together they come up with an interpretation of what the atom actually looks like, a powerful but very tiny nucleus inside it. It's been likened to a fly within a cathedral with electrons whizzing around the outside. You then have one of Rutherford's pupils taking that knowledge further and saying what's lying at the heart of the atom is the neutron, and which of course becomes absolutely fundamental to the understanding of how to create a nuclear chain reaction and ultimately how to make a bomb. At the same time, you have in Germany theoreticians like Werner Heisenberg working on things like quantum mechanics, providing a way of interpreting, of explaining the behavior of atomic particles. So all over the world, you have this sort of intermeshing of experimental data coming out of one set of experiments being interpreted into theory by scientists in another part of the world. This great sort of cobweb of knowledge coming together.
Well, one of when you think about it, and you think about the fact that now that we have the ability to look at what goes on at the atomic and the subatomic level, these people didn't, and that there's something just the tiniest bit mystical about what they must have been doing or how they must have thought as they were trying to think about how things functioned at this level where they really couldn't see. And I'm sure the great challenge was to try to figure out what was going on at that level that they really couldn't see.
Absolutely. I mean, so much of what was discovered was intuitive. It was people making great leaps of the imagination. You just used some very interesting language just now, saying it must have seemed to people a bit like magic. And if you look at the language that the people themselves were using as they made their discoveries, you see Einstein talking about these conferences where they got together and shared their results, or sort of he called them witches' Sabbaths. You find people like Ernest Rutherford, the New Zealand experimentalist, talking about the discoveries he was making, that elements decayed and transmuted into other elements. He said this was really akin to alchemy. He said we're going to have to be very careful how we present these results, because people are just not going to believe us. We know that these things are happening. We've deduced this, but how are we actually going to prove it? How are we going to make people believe that we're right? So there's a great awareness at the time of really pushing back the boundaries, people making these flights of the imagination, these brilliant intellectual leaps, but realizing that they were going to have to come up with hard data, hard proof to actually convince the skeptics around them. And it did at various times completely polarize the scientific community.
Let me just introduce very quickly our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with historian Diana Preston. She is the author of a number of books. She's written about the Boxer Rebellion. She's written about the sinking of the Lusitania, just to name two. She's written about the ill-fated Scott expedition to the South Pole. And she has a couple of times been a guest on our afternoon magazine here, talking with Celeste Quinn about some of her recent writing. And we're pleased she could be here with us this morning on Focus 582. Talk about on her most recent book, which is titled Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima. It's published by Walker, and it does indeed look at this history that goes from, really, before Curie, from the time of the discovery of X-rays by Wilhelm Röntgen in 1895 all the way up to the explosion of the first atomic weapons in 1945. She's traveling around here the United States to talk about her book. She makes her home in England. She will be in Chicago on the campus of the University of Chicago. Fittingly enough, she'll be there on Monday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the 57th Street Bookstore. So if you're interested in stopping by there and you're up in the Chicago area, you can do that. Otherwise, questions are welcome on this show. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm just curious, knowing about some of the other things that you've written about, it seems that it's a long way from the Boxer Rebellion to the atomic bomb. What got you interested in telling this particular story?
I think what made me want to tell it was, I mean, partly, as I was saying earlier, the generation that I belong to, having grown up with the idea of, you know, man having developed the power to destroy our planet, having that overshadowing us, having it affecting, I mean, you know, today, so many aspects of our lives. We worry today about suitcase bombs, we worry about dirty bombs, we worry about non-proliferation. If you listen to the news now, everybody's worried about, you know, what's happening at the moment in North Korea. So many of the things which hang over us and affect our lives go back to this story that I think almost more than any other subject I've written about, I wanted to understand how it all came together as much for myself as anything. I wanted to see how it was that human curiosity, sort of the human chain reaction was triggered by human curiosity in this case, how it led to the conclusion that it did. And I wanted very much to understand the people behind the science, what their motivation was, what their feelings were. And I thought there was no better way of doing that than actually writing this story and also going and talking to those people I could find who had actually been a part of it, to try and get all these years on their perception of what they had really been about, what had gone through their mind at the time. And I just found it, on a personal level, a fascinating journey to make.
Well, let's pick up on that point, because as you have discussed early on, what was in the minds of the people who were doing this work was seemingly was pure science. I mean, they were just interested in trying to understand the world and how it functioned. And early on, and even as we're getting to starting to approach the point of the Manhattan Project, there were people who were saying the very idea of using what they were learning to even to generate energy, much less to make a bomb, seemed wildly improbable, if not impossible. So at the point where we turn the corner, where we go from pure science to the idea of developing a weapon, how did people who were involved in that work think about that? And when it pretty much became clear what the end, where that particular road was going to lead and what it was going to, you know, to the extent they could imagine what it would be like, how did they think about the fact that their work was contributing to the development of the most powerful weapons that human beings have ever had?
Yes, those were very much issues that I wanted to explore. And you find a very rapid transition going on. You go to the winter of 1938 to two refugee scientists sitting on a log out in the snow in Sweden, trying to interpret some experimental results that are coming out of some work that a pair of chemists are doing in Germany. Those chemists can't understand what it is that their experimental data is telling them, so they ask these refugee physicists to try and interpret it. And sitting on a log, you know, literally scribbling on the back of the proverbial envelope, these two, the Austrian Lisa Meitner and her nephew Otto Frisch, they realize that what has actually happened is that these chemists in what is by then Nazi Germany, have managed to split the atom. From that moment, you know, the realization, that knowledge, you know, changes everything. Because these refugee scientists, they go back to their laboratories, they check out the findings, they share it with other people like Niels Bohr, the Dane, who is just on the verge of going over to America to deliver series of lectures. He brings the information about fission to the United States. He announces it at a meeting. Before he's even finished speaking, scientists are rushing out of the room to try it for themselves. So you know, the proof is there that nuclear fission is something which happens. You can split the atom. You can apply Einstein's theory of E equals mc squared to it to prove that the splitting of the atom releases energy. Now, that piece of knowledge can't really come at a worse time. As many of the scientists actually realize at that point, you find a movement amongst some of them saying, well, look, you know, we know this, and the Germans know this, and it's very clear that war is imminent. We've got to do something to prevent this knowledge getting out into wider circulation. We must stop publishing our findings. Some scientists agree to do that. Some don't. The information gets out into the published scientific press. Then you have war breaking out, and you have the allied governments, you know, you have Britain already at war, trying to work out what to do, should they have an atomic project, very fearful that, well, if they don't do it, well, the Germans are going to do it. So you have the idea, at the very least, of deterrence being born at this early stage of the First World War. But, the project accelerates, there are further scientific breakthroughs, people realize that you need far less fissile material, that's enriched uranium, or indeed plutonium to make a bomb than people previously thought. The realization grows that it's actually really quite feasible. It's not technically so difficult, so long as you have the resources. America comes into the frame, the whole thing accelerates, the Manhattan Project gets underway, the technical problems are progressively addressed and broken down and dealt with. You move to the situation where you actually have a device which you can test. We have the first nuclear test happening in July 1945, and you have the scientists sitting on a hill in New Mexico watching this test, and that is really that's the critical moment for them. All those years of work and thought and speculation and of believing they were partaking in a race where it was necessary to develop a weapon, say, before Nazi Germany got there, what was actually in their mind at that point when they realized they'd done it? They saw this first nuclear explosion. Mm. And I talked to a man called Hans Bethe, who was the head of theoretical physics at Los Alamos, who very sadly just died earlier this year. And I asked Hans his feelings about this, that moment of realization that they'd actually done it. They succeeded in creating an explosive chain reaction. I said, what did you feel? What was in your mind? And he said he had two thoughts. His first thought was, you know, how wonderful, we've done it. We've solved the intellectual puzzle. But he said, you know, just a few seconds later, the other thought, the other side of the coin was, okay, we've done it, but how terrible.
Hmm. It does, and obviously different people reacted differently. There were some people who were so overcome with the horror of it that perhaps they never quite got over it. There were other people who perhaps had a kind of an ambivalence, who seemed to feel that the science itself was essentially neutral. And of course, you can get into big arguments about whether science and technology is ever neutral. But they would argue that it's all up to what human beings choose to do with it. And that is yet another matter. And they might argue, in fact, that it's really outside of our area at all. You know, we're scientists. We do the work. It's up to somebody else to decide what happens to it.
That's exactly what Robert Oppenheimer said at one point. Of course, he was the scientific head of the Los Alamos Project. But this is an area that I explore in quite a lot of depth in the book. I wanted to see what people's feelings were about what they were doing at respective stages. And you find sort of at the stage where it is very much perceived as a race between the Allies and Nazi Germany that most people are wholly focused on the task. But then things change a little when you have Germany capitulating in May of 1945, which is several months before we have the test in the New Mexico desert to see whether the atomic bomb that Los Alamos has been working on is actually viable. So you have Germany knocked out of the frame. And it's at that stage people start to think, well, some of them do anyway, what are we actually doing now? We've defeated Germany. What do we need this technology for? What should we do with it? And it seemed to some, I think, that there was almost sort of unstoppable momentum about the project, that the bomb had been developed, and it was going to be dropped somewhere. Mm. If we were still at war on Japan, it was going to be dropped on Japan. And it's interesting to see what some people said about this after the event. You have Einstein, who had been instrumental in the early stages of the war, of warning President Roosevelt that nuclear technology was a reality, that a bomb could be produced, that America must get its hands on as much uranium as possible. You have Einstein, after the event, very ambivalent, saying that, you know, if he had known that the Germans would not be capable of developing a bomb, he would never have lifted a finger to help with the project. You have other scientists, like the Polish physicist Joseph Rotblat, who came to Los Alamos as part of the British contingent. He overheard General Groves, Leslie Groves, who was the overall head of the Manhattan Project, saying one night after the Germans had been defeated that, well, you know, we're developing the bomb, and of course, you know, if we have difficulties with the Russians, we can always use it to demonstrate our might to them. And this really sort of shocked Rotblat. He said, well, wait a moment, the Russians are our allies. What are we talking about doing here? And Rotblat became actually the only senior scientist to walk away from the Los Alamos project on moral grounds. He later got the Nobel Prize for Peace, and he devoted the rest of his life to peaceful uses, you know, medical uses of nuclear applications, and he devoted his life to non-proliferation. So you had a very wide range of views amongst the scientists, but it all comes down to exactly what you were saying, a question of individual responsibility and how each person interpreted that responsibility. Was it to the project? Was it to their country? Was it to mankind at large? And you have many people in the closing stages of the war arguing that, you know, nuclear technology, the science that had been developed, was too important to be left to any one government. They argued, people like Niels Bohr argued very hard for the internationalization of that knowledge and for a regime to be imposed on it. Even before the end of the Second World War, they foresaw what was coming, which was, of course, the arms race of the Cold War.
Well, and that it touches on a very important point, that indeed there were people who thought that the way to deal with the dangers posed by the science would be to essentially give it away, give it out to everybody, open up the books and not keep this a secret, not keep it as something that would be the exclusive property of the United States, but to say to anyone, okay, here it is. But at the same time, of course, not favoring runaway proliferation, but also not keeping it a secret.
Exactly. And that was exactly the line taken by Niels Bohr, the Dane, who had managed, towards the end of the war, he'd escaped from occupied Denmark, he'd come to England, and he'd come over to the United States to advise on the Los Alamos project. But he saw many of the things which happened in the post-war period. He foresaw many of those things, and he was anxious, and he went on a personal crusade, a personal mission to President Roosevelt, arguing for just the things that you were talking about, internationalization, sharing of the knowledge, you know, particularly telling the Russians what was going on. And he also went across to England, and he said the same things to the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. I think Roosevelt was polite to Bohr, but didn't react to what he was saying. Churchill was, I think, downright hostile to Bohr. He thought what he was saying was highly dangerous. Churchill at that stage still very focused on the fact that, you know, the war was not yet won. Britain and her allies mustn't be diverted. He said to his political aides, you know, who was this man, Bohr? I didn't like him. What was he saying? I think he is in danger of committing mortal crimes. He even said, you know, perhaps we should lock him up.
Hmm. I want to get you to talk about what is a subject that I know has engendered a lot of debate and discussion, and that is what we know about the state of the German nuclear program. As you say, the scientists elsewhere had the idea that knew that the Germans did indeed have a program. They were working on it, and the great fear was that the Nazis should develop the bomb first. And that's what stimulated this enormous push for the United States to develop the Manhattan Project and to spend whatever it would take to concentrate this number of scientists and engineers at Los Alamos and to develop the project. Now, there has been, as I say, I think a lot of debate about the Germans and just how advanced their program was, whether indeed they would have been capable of producing a weapon, and specifically what the role of some German scientists were, because it has been argued two ways, either that the German scientists recognized just how bad it would be if Hitler had a atomic weapon, and so they dragged their heels. They deliberately sabotaged the program. On the other hand, it's been argued that, no, that's not the case. They just didn't for one reason or another, didn't have the understanding of what it would take to do it. And so, in fact, they couldn't have done it because they didn't have the most basic knowledge, or some of their assumptions were wrong, or something like that. It was their grasp of the science that was the problem, not the fact that they recognized this would be a terrible thing for the Nazis to have, and that they decided they were going to make sure the Nazis didn't have them. Well, can you sort all that out, and can we truly say that one or the other of those is correct?
Yes. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at what was actually going on in the German program, and have helped with some recently released, the previously secret documents from the German atomic program, which have now been made available. And I was trying to unravel the story of, you know, what was really going on there, and what was in their minds, and how much did they really know? And if you go back to the start of the war, as I say, it was, you know, experiments done by two German chemists in Berlin, Otto Hahn and his assistant Fritz Strassmann, which actually provided the first evidence that you could split the atom and release energy. So the basics of fission at the start of the war were really quite well understood in Germany. This is what frightened so many of the refugee scientists so much. They knew these German scientists very well. They'd studied with them for years. They'd all been together at universities and seminars. They knew how talented people like Werner Heisenberg was, and others. They knew that these German scientists were clever, that they had a reasonable level of theoretical knowledge at that point. It seemed to them completely conceivable that the Nazis could be on the track of putting together a nuclear device. And you find in the early stages of the war, German scientists actually alerting the German authorities to the possibilities of the technology. You have the German army calling a conference of scientists. Werner Heisenberg is one of the people who gets summoned to that. And they put together what they call a uranium club, and they devote resources to it. Heisenberg builds himself a laboratory which was nicknamed the Virus House to try and convince people that what was going on was some sort of research into infectious diseases or something. But at the early in the early stages of the war, you, of course, have these people cut off from the colleagues that they used to have all these scientific exchanges with. There's no free flow of information anymore. A lot of stuff in the published literature has dried up. So, if you like, people are starting to work in a vacuum. And what I found was that you have the German scientists starting to make mistakes in some of their assumptions. They're trying to look at how you can enhance the possibility of fissioning atoms, how you can slow... If you're using neutrons to bombard an atom, to fissure that atom and cause further releases of neutrons, to cause further fissions, in other words, to cause a nuclear chain reaction, you know, they're trying to find ways of slowing neutrons down to make that more efficient and effective, and they went down the wrong path. They got hung up on using heavy water, an isotope of hydrogen, as a way of slowing down neutrons. That came from some mistaken interpretations of experiments. And so, of course, you get them fixated on that. You get all the story of the heavy water plants in occupied Norway and the Nazis trying to milk those plants for as much heavy water as they could get. But, in fact, they were on the wrong track. And at the same time, that's just an example of one of the basic assumptions they got wrong about what to do. At the same time, they had nothing like the resources. You know, we were talking earlier about the huge resources that the United States was able to put into developing plants to actually make enough fissile material to fuel bombs. You know, I mentioned earlier that ultimately the Manhattan Project and the subsidiary cost, I mean, it came to something like the cost of the U.S. car industry. The Germans at war under, you know, especially getting to the middle to the end of the war, massive bombardment from the Allies, they couldn't do that sort of thing. Their experiments, if you look at what was actually going on, were on a very small scale. You have some interesting things going on as the war develops. You have the famous or infamous visit from Werner Heisenberg to Copenhagen, occupied Copenhagen, to see his old friend and mentor, Niels Bohr. And people have argued, well, what was really going on there? You know, Heisenberg said, well, actually, we were going with, you know, German scientists, we were going to Copenhagen to tell Niels Bohr that we were looking at nuclear technology, but we were trying not to build a bomb, and we wanted Bohr to pass that message to the Allies so the Allies wouldn't build a bomb to drop on Germany. And that was the line that's still being pursued by another German scientist, Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, who wrote to me about this and who was with Heisenberg at that meeting. So you have a lot of, I think, there's still a lot of ambiguity about what was really going on. Were they on a fishing expedition to Copenhagen to find out what the Allies knew about nuclear technology, or were they really trying to pass messages? But you go from that meeting through to the end of the war, where you get conclusive proof of how off-beam the German program had got. You have the Allies sending a special mission in, the Alsace mission, racing behind the just behind the invading Allied troops, trying to pick up every German scientist they knew of, trying to get to every facility, because no one knew, you know, just how far the Germans really had got. And what they actually find is something on a very small scale. They find something which looks by Allied standards at this stage completely ridiculous. You find little experiments hidden away in caves, underground, tiny scale stuff, sort of experiments that could really be loaded into a couple of lorries, as indeed they had been when they'd been evacuated out of Berlin. You compare that with the massive plants and facilities which have been built in the United States for making enriched uranium and plutonium, covering miles and miles and miles of land, huge sites employing, you know, 30 or 40,000 people. Nothing like that in Germany. So I think that the real prospects for the Germans being able to build a serious explosive device, absolutely minimal. And then I leap from that, you know, what the Allies actually find when they get into occupied countries and finally into Germany itself, which shows very small-scale experiments. I go from that to the interviews, which were secretly taped. When the Allies got into Germany, they arrested all the nuclear scientists they could find. They shipped them back to England, and they interned them in a farmhouse in Cambridgeshire called Farm Hall. And unknown to those German scientists, their conversations were being taped. And so you have these very interesting transcripts of what the German scientists said to each other when they were told the news of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. And they're absolutely amazed. The first reaction was, it can't possibly be true. You know, they're lying to us. We don't think it could have been done. You know, how could they possibly have solved the problems? How could they possibly have done it? And at the same time, you have them starting to jibe at each other. You know, one of them says to Werner Heisenberg, well, you know, this must be a surprise for you. It shows just how wrong your thinking was. You know, you must be quite embarrassed about it. So I've covered it, and that's a huge amount of ground. Yeah. But I just wanted sort of to try and paint a picture of sort of what had happened during those 5 years of the war, from going to the stage where the level of knowledge was virtually the same, I suppose, in Germany to what it was in Europe to what it was in America, to how you have this complete dichotomy in terms of scientific developments and the resources put into it.
So it was perhaps a combination of both not having the resources and, as you say, being cut off from the other people who were doing the work. So there was really no opportunity to bounce their ideas off of others, find out what other people are thinking. The scientists were isolated.
Exactly. Apart from that, you know, that very ambiguous visit to Copenhagen. Yeah. But you also, you raised a very interesting point about, well, what was really in the mind of German scientists? Were they actually doing their very best to try and build a bomb, or were they trying to, if you like, go slow? Because they didn't, they were by no means all of them committed Nazis. Many of them were actually very antipathetical to the Nazis, not Nazis at all. So what were they really trying to do? Were they in fact trying to hold things up? And I think if you look at what's going on in the German program, you see different things happening at different stages and different scientists trying to do different things. Now, Werner Heisenberg is always the interesting one to look at, probably the most gifted of all the German theoreticians, later a leading scientist in post-war Germany, a Nobel Prize winner, a friend of many of the scientists over on the Allied side. You know, so what was really in his mind? And you know, the conclusion I came to was that he had no real passion, I think, for Nazi Germany to be the first to have a nuclear device they could explode. He had a rather naive view of politics, and he thought that eventually, you know, the Nazis and so this was an evil regime which could be overcome, and the good elements of Germany could be salvaged, and it was only a question of time before that happened. But at the same time, and I think this partly explains his visit to Copenhagen, he was terrified that the Allies would get there and that they would drop a bomb on Germany. So therefore, we felt we had, you know, the German scientists had some responsibility not to allow that to happen, to leave Germany without the ability to defend itself. Heisenberg and many of the others, they were, you know, they may not have been Nazis, but they were still German patriots.
Well, not to put too fine a point on all of this, but I guess that my bottom line sort of curiosity does have to do with those people who would paint Werner Heisenberg as something of some kind of a hero, because through deliberate action he contributed to the fact that the Germans did not ultimately end up with a bomb. And it would seem as if for anybody who would take that position that the facts don't seem to bear that out.
I don't believe that. I think it's. I found no evidence at all that he had deliberately tried to slow the German program down. I did find evidence that at various stages he had made genuine mistakes, been misled by other scientists in the team, and examples of him expressing genuine anger about that. He was enough of a. At the end of the day, these people, they were all scientists, a burning desire to know how to solve problems, to know what was around the next corner. That was as much a motivator as anything else. So the picture of Heisenberg as some sort of hero, I think that's a naive view. I think he was very much more complicated than that. I think his own motivation varied at various stages of the war. I think he was probably not even clear or honest perhaps to himself about what he actually really wanted to happen. This idea of, and this is what they call in German the laser art, the version which was developed after the war to try and explain, you know, why the Germans hadn't developed a bomb. I think it was as much to do about going down blind alleys and making mistakes and not having the resources and also, you know, not being a cohesive team in the way that the Allied scientists were. There were rivalries between Heisenberg and others in his group. At one stage, even when they get evacuated from Berlin in the dying days of the war, one German scientist goes off with half of Werner Heisenberg's kit, and he has to literally fight to get it back so he can set his experiment up. They're doing experiments to the very last. And their sort of anger and outrage and confusion when they're interned and they hear the news of Hiroshima shows to me that they were actually trying quite hard to solve the basic problems of how to achieve a self-sustaining chain reaction, how to actually solve the problems of putting together a nuclear device, and indeed how to actually solve the problems of putting together a nuclear power reactor. Because they had talked very frequently to the army authorities about the possibilities of powering submarines and ships using nuclear power as a method of helping the German war effort.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Diana Preston. Her new book looks at this history that we've been talking about, stretching from the discovery of radiation all the way through the development and detonation of the first atomic bombs. Her book is titled Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima, and it's published by Walker. She's now spending some time in the United States. She's out on the West Coast to talk about her book. And next week, on Monday, we'll be on the campus of the University of Chicago at the 57th Street Bookstore, 7 o'clock Monday evening. So you would have the opportunity, if you're up that way, of hearing from her. And, of course, if you're interested in reading the book Before the Fallout, you can head out to your favorite bookstore. We do have a caller here. We have about 5 minutes left. We'll get them in right at this point in Champaign County on line number one. Hello.
Hi. You referred to the Oppenheimer and some kind of conversation or memo from Samuel Gove. Was he a major general or something? Charge of the Manhattan Project?
Leslie Groves,
yeah. What was that specifically? Was that a memo or was that a conversation? Because I've heard Oppenheimer discussed, but I've never heard an explicit reference to the kind of demonstration to the Soviets kind of line. And I'm just wondering how solid that is and where you found that, and is that a new document of some kind, or
no? That's what I was referring to. That's very solid. If you look in there's a very interesting book, sort of edited letters and sort of combined edited letters and biography of Oppenheimer, you will find what I was describing referred to there. And everything, what I was particularly anxious to do in the book, particularly when talking about people's views and opinions on these sensitive areas, was to make sure that I was able to source everything back to to where I found it, to the conversation, to the letter, to the memo. So if you look in the book, you know, you will find all those sorts of references there.
Okay, well, Oppenheimer, you have the letter from his side of it, but do you have anything from Groves, Leslie Groves himself, about sort of corroborating that similar conversation happened? Or
This is the conversation about
that alienated Oppenheimer. It's talking about demonstrating to the Soviets and opening the Cold War.
Well, the person that I was talking about being really alienated by what Groves was saying was not Oppenheimer, it was Joseph Rotblat, Polish physicist.
That too.
Sorry, I thought, yes, I was talking about another thing I was referring to with, you know, Robert Oppenheimer's views on what should happen sort of post-war on the nuclear technology. But it was Joseph Rotblat who was... He was a part of the British mission that had come to Los Alamos, and he was at dinner with a man called James Chadwick, who had also come across from Britain, who was head of the British nuclear mission in the United States at this stage. And Leslie Groves was there at dinner, and that's where that conversation took place, where Groves was sounding quite sort of gung-ho and quite cavalier about, you know, using the, you know, the discovery of a nuclear technology, the fact that, you know, a bomb was being developed, using that as a way to subdue the Soviet Union. That's what really worried Joseph Rotblat. That's what made him, the most senior scientist to walk away from the Los Alamos project at that point. And that is, I've corroborated that by, it's in many articles that Joseph Rotblat has written. And he now lives in London. He's still very much involved in non-proliferation, and he talked to me about it again when I was interviewing him for the material in the book.
Because it explicitly talks about a military fellow having the strategy of, you know, demonstrating to the Soviets, which is still an object of contention about why the bomb was dropped, etc. Something that I just found out in the last couple of days that you might be interested in is, and I don't have the actual name of this New York Times writer, but apparently a New York Times writer who was hired to be a press release writer for the Manhattan Project also flew on the Enola Gay mission, or actually the Nagasaki mission.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it would be on yes.
And he wrote a glowing, no pun intended, description of the bomb. The media conference that just happened, the keynote, or one of the evening addresses by Amy Goodman, includes her reading these quotes from this journalist whose name escapes me, but it'll be up on the WLL website, and so people can check into that. And I certainly would like to follow it up. I don't know if you had seen that. It sounds like you did a rather encyclopedic look at all of this. So appreciate your effort.
All right. Oh, thank you. No, I didn't. I did look at the certainly what the journalist William Lawrence wrote about how the Manhattan Project was developing, and I found, you know, some of his comments extremely fascinating in explaining what was going on in people's minds at the time.
We're getting very, very short on time here, and I'm afraid we won't really have time for any more callers. And my apologies to the people there, because we're going to stray past our time. One thing, though, I am just a little bit curious, if folks would and not mind indulging me, is to ask you about what you're working on now. What's your next project going to be?
Oh, well, that's sort of the Monty Python people would say something completely different. It's going to be a book about the Taj Mahal, the love story that inspired it, the architecture, the context within which it was built, this really iconic building, this universal story. So I'm deep in the research for that at the moment.
Your interests certainly range very wide, I must say. Is there something that you think, though, that ties all of these very things, the Lusitania and the Boxer Rebellion and the Taj Mahal and Scott of the Antarctic and the atomic bomb, that somehow ties all those things together?
I suppose I've got very interested in, you know, some of the big defining moments of 20th century history, watersheds, if you like. In Lusitania, very much a watershed. The story of Scott, very much a way of understanding sort of the psyche of the time. But I've also, you know, very much enjoy earlier history, the history of the 17th century, Hence, you know, I wrote a book with my husband, Mike, about a 17th century pirate. I wanted to go back to the 17th century, which is the period when the Taj Mahal was built, to see sort of what was going on in the Mughal Empire, how that related to what was going on across the world. So though sometimes the links sound a little bit tenuous, there are connections, I suppose, between the things that I do. But above all, I mean, apart from I have no overall strategy, what really matters to me is just that I personally find the subject that I choose completely compelling. And if you're going to give 2 or 3 years of your life to something, it's got to be something which really grips you.
All right. Well, if people would like to read the book that we've been talking about here, it's titled Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima, published by Walker, by our guest Diana Preston. It's just out, and certainly you should be able to find it in the bookstore, along with some of her others. And if you're in the Chicago area, she will be giving a talk at the 57th Street Bookstore on the University of Chicago campus next Monday, that's the 16th, at 7 o'clock in the evening. So you should be welcome to stop by. And Ms. Preston, we want to say to you, thanks very much.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.